Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. We're less than a week away from the midterm elections in the U.S., and the outcome couldn't be more important with so much at stake. Voting rights, long in the crosshairs of Republicans since the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, are under intense attack, as are some voters in Arizona who've reported being harassed and stalked by armed vigilantes as they drop off their ballots at official drop boxes provided by the Board of Elections. In some 300 state races, Republican candidates running for governorships, secretaries of state, judges, and Congress subscribe to the myth that the 2020 election was stolen. As analysts have pointed out, if just one governor in one state chooses to deny the results of that state's election tally in a close presidential race, it could actually throw the entire election. If just one secretary of state refuses to certify the state's election, it could have the same effect. And we've heard directly from some of these candidates that, if elected, they have every intention of refusing to abide by the state's election results, if a Democratic candidate wins. Even Brazil's defeated far-right President Bolsonaro, the so-called Trump of the tropics, has admitted defeat, or at least not actively challenged his loss. And Brazil is a perfect example of the dire importance of the elections here. The new incoming president in Brazil, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, has pledged to end deforestation in the Amazon, which has accelerated under Bolsonaro, a climate change denier. Many other issues of critical importance face us here in the U.S., including reproductive rights, which are the right-wing Supreme Court has already allowed states to rescind, affirmative action, which is about to be eliminated by that same court. Various environmental protections and anti-discrimination laws are being targeted, and even marriage equality could come under fire and will have no protection if Republicans take control. For anyone who naively claims that voting doesn't make a difference, consider that in Georgia, a smart, thoughtful junior senator, Raphael Warnock, is at the moment pulling a point or two behind the former football star, who can't even form a coherent sentence much of the time, and who supports a national ban on abortion. We get jaded when election after election ends in disappointment, or when people we elect, like the Columbus's own Democratic City Council or mayor or school board, act against our interests and seem duplicitous or unaccountable. But to not vote, or to cast only a symbolic vote for a dark horse candidate with no chance of winning, is to look at these existential threats in the face and to say, bring it on, I really don't care. And, well, maybe you're chronically unemployed or not seeking work, or you already have a secure job, or like me, you're self-employed and think that racial, sexual, and other discrimination won't affect you. Maybe you're white and you think you'll never face police brutality or redlining by lenders. Maybe you're male and think that reproductive rights, including abortion, are just not a priority for you, personally, because they don't apply. Maybe you're registered to vote and have never had a problem voting and never will, but one thing that directly affects you, that will definitely directly affect you, because it affects all of us, is the planet's climate change. That's one thing you really can't escape or ignore, and it's getting more intense. It made the news briefly a couple of months ago after several small towns in Kentucky, just 3 hours from this signal area, were completely submerged by flooding. I mean, water up to the rafters flooding. People died in recent storms in Florida and on the East Coast. Fires in California and New Mexico consumed hundreds of thousands of acres. Drought in the Southwest and Central Plains is reducing agricultural production. And the warmer winters are allowing invasive species and diseases to spread north, including into our state. Human migration, too, is becoming a global problem as folks flee the global south due to heat and drought, as well as political violence and poverty, all of which are connected. One might criticize the Democratic Party and the current and previous Democratic administrations for doing too little to address climate change, and that case can certainly be made, but Republicans have shown a willingness, or eagerness even, to reverse progress on fighting climate change. They're all about more reliance on fossil fuels and eliminating environmental protections and even suppressing renewable energy. And not only that, but they'll pack the courts with judges likely to rule against environmental protections going forward. For these reasons, I've chosen to devote the show to climate change as an election-related issue, And I have a recording of an opening plenary from a climate change conference held earlier this year in New Delhi, India. It was organized by an Indian independent media outlet called WION, whose executive director, Palki Sharma Uvadayas, is the first person you'll hear speaking.
Why are we talking about climate change in the middle of a war? Why are we talking about climate change in the middle of a pandemic? Because time and again, we have let politics overshadow climate conversations. We have let the pandemic come in the way of climate policy. It's time to take a fresh look at our priorities, we say. It's time to bring the focus back on climate change, and for that, today is as good a day as any. Climate change, ladies and gentlemen, is the biggest crisis of our times. You may be surprised to learn that climate-related incidents kill more people every year than violence. We are talking about at least 15 times more deaths. So this is not an environmental problem anymore. This is a humanitarian problem. Our planet is heating up. Our lives are in danger. Our future generations are in danger. A child born today becomes a smoker from day one. Air pollution has become the fourth largest threat to human health, only behind high blood pressure, dietary risks, and smoking. And this is just one of the many, many problems at hand. Some of you in the audience would agree with me when I say that Delhi would never be this warm on a March evening. But look at the temperature on your phones now. This, ladies and gentlemen, is climate change. Ignoring it is no longer an option. So I welcome you to this summit, Climate Calling, the last chance to answer the climate emergency. I'm happy that so many of you answered our calls, and so many of you have traveled across oceans to join us. And a big thank you to those of you who are joining us virtually today, and to our audience for tuning in from nearly 200 countries. I would also like to thank our sponsors, Green Partner Go Mechanic, and Beyond Climate Summit, co-powered by Fujitsu General and Mobius Foundation. Ladies and gentlemen, you'll all be happy to learn that Vion is also at the forefront of climate reportage. I'm very proud to say that we are the only international channel which has a daily show dedicated to climate stories. Vion understands the gravity of this crisis, and Vion is sincere in its efforts to raise awareness. I'm proud to introduce to you the concept of Vion.
Malik. City of Mariupol, over 2,100 people in the city have died.
It is going to be unprecedented.
The meeting started early Saturday.
The police have called this criminality unacceptable.
Hamas rocket that was fired into the city.
Conflict or climate?
For what in Hong Kong are called compulsory testing orders.
Pandemic or politics.
The announcement of the AUKUS, where does that leave the Quad?
There is use of weaponry as
Make yourself as small as possible.
War and peace. The world's channel of choice is WION. Reliable, factual, intelligent, and clutter-free. India's first global news channel is setting the agenda worldwide with human stories that should be told.
Potentially a different way forward.
Extensive airstrikes against Gaza.
Questions that must be asked.
The president was one of those who gave 16th of February as the possible date of invasion.
We call it a terrorist group.
Analysis that can be trusted.
As Western countries, which are historically, morally, politically, and perhaps even financially responsible for climate change.
See the amount of firing that has been done in order to push back the Taliban.
I wear this mask.
This is how it's going to look.
The jets that get sent to Ukraine.
The cost of oil has absolutely rocketed.
Ground reportage that takes you straight to the action.
Nuclear powered weapons are weapons.
India's pride, the world's choice. With a footprint in nearly 200 countries, at the top of global digital charts, and at the heart of every action.
Police really here are taking no risk.
WION is all you need. WION is all in one. WION, world is one.
Thank you. Once again, a very warm welcome to the VEON Climate Summit. I would now like to invite VEON CEO and Editor-in-Chief, Mr. Sudhir Chaudhary, to deliver the opening address.
He is the CEO and Editor-in-Chief of VEON. Delivering the opening address is Mr. Sudhir Chaudhary.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's my pleasure and honor to welcome you all at VEON's first climate summit, but not the last. And today I want to start with a few questions. What is our top priority when we look at the problems that need to be solved? Like, take for example, my own country, India. For decades, we have been focusing on bijli, sadak, pani, means electricity, roads, water, food. And our entire politics has been centered on these basic issues. And even today, these issues remain the primary issues of discussion for the average citizen. They are being discussed in elections and everywhere on the streets. On the other hand, issues like climate change, issues like mental health, are discussed on very elite forums of international conferences and seminars. The common citizen and even the mainstream media is still far away from these issues. And they still think that climate change is someone else's problem and it will never touch their lives. But the fact is that climate change is already changing our lives. It's a reality. It's all around us. I will give you a most basic example about my own life. I want to share some personal experiences which are very basic in nature, but they tell the story of the impact of climate change. And I'll start from myself. I come from a middle-class Indian family, and I bought my first air conditioner when I started working. Before that stage, I neither felt the need nor did I have the money to buy the AC. But today, life without an air conditioner, even one day without an air conditioner, is unthinkable. I wonder what has changed now. Me, the city where I live, or the climate? And I guess all of these. During my childhood, we used to have water coolers in our house, not the air conditioners. And we were fine with it. One day, I asked my father, how did we survive all those years without an air conditioner? We used to spend afternoons under the shade of a tree, drink water from earthen pots, and felt the fresh, cool breeze every morning and evening that seems to have disappeared now. It's so rare now. Today we have air purifiers in our houses, in literally every room. Recently, I bought a new car, and the salesman told me that they have added a new feature and the car now comes with an air purifier and an AQI monitor. Climate change can push us back to a situation when we'll be deprived even of our basic needs. We are constantly innovating our products and our lifestyle to suit the changing climate, but not doing enough to arrest the change. I'm no climate expert. I'm not a domain expert. And I realize this fact that people like me, I mean, I'm a journalist, I host shows every night, and I sometimes report about climate change also. But I still feel, I realize that I need to know more. My viewers, all of us, we need to know more. And the realization that we need to know more is the first basic step. So this summit is an attempt to change our approach. Today, as a news channel, we want to offer this platform to the domain experts, to the policy makers, to all of you, to raise awareness and take the steps that need to be taken. Once again, I welcome you all to the VEON Climate Summit. Thank you so much, and I hope you will enjoy the evening. Thank you.
Over the next 3 hours, we hope to have conversations that will echo beyond these walls. And we hope to to have a conversation that will bring or suggest implementable solutions. So let's start with the first session of the evening, Road to Change, Understanding Climate Change.
This is our world, and it is changing with climate change. Rains have reduced in Australia. In India, Kaziranga National Park has become a net carbon emitter. Only 25% migratory birds have shown up in Albania this year. In the UK, plants are flowering earlier than usual. The Amazon is losing its green cover. But the tundra is becoming greener. The world's coldest place is on fire. Animals and humans are being charred alike. Our homes are sinking. And our children are growing up in a dangerous world. This is our world. And it is upon us to stop this change. Let's start by understanding climate change. Session 1, Road to Change, Understanding Climate Change. The dialogue partners for this session are Ramina Gurib Fakim, former president of Mauritius. Erik Solheim, former minister of international development of Norway. Ken O'Flaherty, the United Kingdom's COP26 ambassador for Asia Pacific and South Asia. Divya Dutt, Program Management Officer of the United Nations Environment Programme in India. Moderating this session is Palki Sharma Upadhyay, Executive Editor of WEON.
Hello again, good to have all of you here. I'll start with you. Amina Gurib Fakim, you worked tirelessly on climate change. You have pushed for solutions, you've pushed for global solidarity, you've pushed for science-based efforts to arrest climate change. What does it feel like when you see that climate breakdown is happening faster than anticipated and the impact is worse than anticipated?
First of all, Palki, thank you for having me and thank you for Jan for giving me the opportunity to raise again my voice on this, what I call now an existential threat to humanity. Unfortunately, Palki, the world is still not waking up to this crisis, and it is for us, especially islanders, an existential threat. And I feel that until and unless we treat climate change as an emergency, we will not handle it as such. And this is, I think, where the conversation, the gap happens in the conversation. We are not taking it seriously. We are acting like that frog in that tepid water, which is gradually warming up. And very soon, there'll be no time for adaptation because we're getting too tired and we'll just end up in the boiling water.
Very well put, as always. Erik Solheim, you've had an extensive career focusing on climate change, on the environment, and you've pushed the private sector to do more. You've pushed for more investment in conservation efforts. But here we are, and in this day and age, national parks have become carbon emitters. What will it take for the world to hear the SOS call and actually act on it?
Thank you so much for having me on this important event. True, as Amina said, the problem is huge, but we are also more and more now stepping up to the plate and acting. And I will point to a few B's which are now acting. First of all, business. In all nations, business are now well ahead of the political leaders, and no nation has even close to acting in the way like say, Microsoft is doing in the US, IKEA is doing in Europe, or April, the world's biggest paper and pulp company, is doing in Asia. Secondly, Brussels, the European Union, is regulating markets in Europe in a completely new way. Thirdly, Beijing. China is now the lead on every single environment technology, whether it's solar or wind or green hydrogen or electric mobility. China is the lead nation. And fourthly, Bharat or India Prime Minister Modi has put India on a completely new trajectory, launching the Green Hydrogen Mission for India, going big into solar very soon. India will be the second biggest solar nation in the world. So I see a lot of reasons for optimism also, while the problem is big. But we have acted more during the COVID-19 than we did for many, many years before. I think in reality, we have done a lot more in the last 2 years than we did in the last 20 years before that.
Divya, that you've researched extensively on energy and climate change in India in particular and the world in general. I know a lot needs to be done, but the fact that political parties are including climate change in their manifestos, the fact that governments are actually at least making an effort to be seen to be doing something, would you say that we should be looking at the glass half full?
Well, thank you for that question. I'd say, you know, for us, I think it's more important to look at the glass half empty and take action. Because if you look at the assessments that are being done now and the science that is being generated, including by UNEP, you know, there is sort of a target of 1.5 degrees Celsius that we've set for ourselves, or we should set for ourselves. But even with all the unconditional commitments and all the pledges that countries have taken, we are looking at a temperature rise by the end of the century of 2.7 degrees Celsius. So even with all the commitments that we've made, we are far ahead even of 2 degrees Celsius. And we know that anything beyond 1.5 degrees will be catastrophic. You know, we are already in many parts of the world, we are seeing catastrophes, we are seeing disasters of a scale that is unprecedented. We've not seen it ever in our lifetimes. But at 2 degrees, I think we cannot even begin to imagine where we will be and what are the kinds of impacts of climate change that we'll be seeing. To reach that 1.5 degrees Celsius, we need to halve GHG emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, in the next 8 years, by 2030. So that is a kind of ambition that we need to have. And I think it is only with, you know, we've seen a lot of countries make net zero commitments. We've seen a lot of businesses make net zero commitments. I think it is important that these long-term, mid-century net zero commitments are translated into immediate short-term action. Only then can we sort of, you know, do we have any chance at all of, you know, of that little window that we have for 1.5 degrees.
Right, and the window that is shrinking fast. Ken O'Flaherty, you've advocated nature-based solutions for Asia-Pacific. Water levels we know are rising in this part of the world. Indonesia, for one, is moving its capital city. One third of Bangladesh was underwater until recently. In another part of the world, ice caps are melting faster than ever before. What, according to you, is accelerating this the most?
I know the increasing global temperatures are having devastating effects on ecosystems and biodiversity worldwide. And so it's impossible to say that one country is suffering more than others. But certainly in recent months, we have seen extreme weather events across the globe. And these are having major impacts on economies, on communities across the Asia Pacific region. We're also seeing problems around deforestation across Asia in particular. And we're seeing coral reefs increasingly threatened and damaged. And we know in a 2 degrees Celsius world, for example, 98% of all coral reefs should be destroyed, whereas in a 1.5 degrees Celsius world, there is a much greater chance of survival. And of course, these coral reefs are essential for fisheries, for tourism, and for the economies of major countries across this region. So we are being convinced as COP26 presidency that nature-based solutions have to be an integral part of all countries' approach towards tackling the impacts of climate change. We know that one third of the most cost-effective solutions to climate change are nature-based solutions. We, therefore, as the UK, are trying to lead by example by allocating a much greater proportion of our climate finance towards these solutions across this region. But we also know that partners are recognizing the importance of preserving forests in the region. So it was great to see at Glasgow in COP26 so many countries in this region signing up to the Forestry and Land Use Declaration. Our COP president was recently in Indonesia and heard about the work that they're doing there to protect their forests and indeed regenerate large amounts of their forests. And I myself was in Sri Lanka and Bangladesh very recently, and I saw firsthand how that work is underway to protect the mangroves in many of these countries, which are also crucial for providing livelihoods for the future and also in capturing the carbon. They are often more cost-effective than forests in that regard. So yes, you're absolutely right. Nature-based solutions have been a key part of our approach as COP26 presidency. Of course, alongside the other work on driving down emissions, achieving net zero, making sure there's strong 2030 targets, eliminating the use of coal, for example, as well as supporting our partners on adaptation and loss and damage, as well as delivering greater international climate finance.
Indeed. Although, was COP26 a success or not remains a question of debate. Amina Gharib Fakim, I have some very interesting numbers with me. It says, between 2010 and 2020, droughts, floods and storms killed 15 times as many people in highly vulnerable countries in Africa, South Asia and South America as in wealthier countries. Would you say the impact of climate change is discriminatory in nature, and why is that?
I used to think that it was discriminatory in nature, because when you see the impact of climate change, you see that mostly the vulnerable people actually being impacted. And here I'm going to be very blunt. I think that we're getting traction, we're getting visibility on climate change, because the countries in the north now are also being impacted by climate change. And I think this is for real. We've seen that. We've seen fires in Australia, in places that we'd never thought we'd see flooding. And I'm not going to say that it's serving anybody. It's not going to serve anybody. But I think now the awareness has been raised that this is now for real, and we have to tackle it. But unfortunately, we know what the problems are. We know what the solutions are, and I don't think we're moving fast enough. I see some countries, they're putting target to 2050, but I don't think nature will wait for us until politically we meet the target. We know what the problem is. The problem is emission. We have to cut, we have to reduce emission. And I still do not see how this can happen. And as you, what you said, what we've seen earlier on, with the war in Ukraine, I think climate change has been put back in the back burner. So this is, in a way, a welcome effort that WEON has put this together, that it will bring in the conversation further again, because while the war might stop, climate change will accelerate.
That's a fair point, and we will come to the war as well. But you've been the president of your country, and you've said that we're behaving like that frog. I agree with you when you say that it's got more visibility because the global north is being affected. But why do you think, if everyone agrees that this is a problem and we have a fair idea what the solutions will look like, why aren't more governments and leaders doing what needs to be done? Would you say that good climate policy makes bad politics?
I don't think I think we have to go further back. I think we have to look at after the Second World War, when we were setting up all these multilateral organizations. We are setting up the UN, for example, and the conversation was about, for example, measuring GDP growth. We know that GDP growth is measured by virtue of extraction. In fact, the entire model, the business model of our world, is built on extraction. So for as long as we're going to have this approach of looking at our GDP, at our growth, we will be having this conversation forever. So I think it is time to rethink how we measure our growth, what are the indicators we will target. But unfortunately, some continent like mine, African continent, we have a very, very tight window for growth, because even though we have emitted only 4% or less of greenhouse gas emission, we are going to be impacted more. So I think this is, again, the conversation must be had. What is the carbon window that countries must be allowed so that they can grow the economy and fulfill the responsibilities and the promises to the people, and at the same time coax those who have been polluting to reduce the carbon impact?
Which brings us back to the question, Divya, who is going to be deciding that?
I think we know what needs to be done, as was just said. I think the science is very clear. It's very unequivocal about where we are headed, what we need to do. I think the solutions are there. I think we need commitment. And, I think the mechanisms, the global mechanisms, are all in place. And eventually the success of any mechanism is in how invested stakeholders are in the success of that mechanism. So I don't think we need to sort of rejig systems. I think we have everything in place. We have the solutions. In fact, for a lot of climate, environmental crises, not just for climate, the solutions are there. I think it's just now
the kind of commitment that we need, not just from governments, but from businesses, from civil society, to take solutions at a scale where they will begin to show impact and a difference is what we need.
I want to take this question to Eric Solheim. You've worked very closely in this area, and you've pushed for more aid for less developed countries, and yet we see climate politics emerging as the biggest hurdle to climate action. There is a debate over historical emissions. There is a debate over who is going to pay more, where will the solutions come from, and what happens to developing countries. How do we expect to create a global response to a global crisis, given all of these fault lines?
I think we need to change the conversation, because the old idea was first you prioritize economic development and you make a hell of pollution, and then you get rich, you solve the problem. That is the old model. That's the 20th century. The 21st century is all about the win-win policies. All those policies which are good for the environment, good for people's health and well-being, and good for economy and growth at the same time. And we have them all. Green tourism, green agriculture, renewable economics, electric mobility, they're all available. And I think we environmentalists need to make a new conversation. They have tried to scare people into action. It didn't work. Now it's time to inspire people into action. And if you allow me a few inspiring examples from India on nature-based solution, which Ken spoke so nicely about. In the state of Telangana, they have increased the tree cover by 3% over the last few years. That's really impressive. In the state of Maharashtra, they're embarking upon a much better mangrove protection. Again, great service. In the city of Bengaluru, Save Trees, an Indian NGO, has made 30 small forests in the city, making the life of people better, but also, of course, making climate action happening. And finally, in Andhra Pradesh, they have moved 1 million farmers. That means 6 million people with the families into green, zero-budget, or zero-emission farming. Supported by the central government, but supported by the different ministers, chief ministers of Andhra Pradesh. It's huge service. And they set out all these inspirational examples to call on people to do a lot more of this.
Indeed, and Mumbai has set itself a net zero target for 2050. So efforts are being made. But Ken O'Flaherty, like we all agree, I think a lot more needs to be done. And climate migration is something that not many people are discussing yet, but that's an imminent crisis that we're looking at. Climate refugees. Estimates say West Africa could see up to 32 million people being forced to move by 2050. Where will all of these people go?
If I could perhaps just on the back of the last conversation say that I do think that at Glasgow we did see a marked step change in the commitment of governments to tackling climate change. When the UK took our COP26 presidency on 2 years ago, only 30% of the world's economy was covered by net zero targets. Today, that's over 90%. So I think we have seen recognition by leaders across the globe of the existential threat that is posed by climate change. Now, other colleagues on the panel have mentioned that it's not enough to have net zero targets. We have to ensure that action is being taken now so that we can keep the 1.5 degrees Celsius target alive. On that, I think the outcome of Glasgow was very important, that all countries committed to reviewing their domestic plans for 2030 this year and to come to Sharm el-Sheikh at COP27 in November with clear revised plans where those were not compatible with the 1.5 degrees Celsius target. So I think we are seeing that action. I very much agree with colleagues who've also said that it's important to keep this at the top of leaders' attention. We have referred to some of the other competing objectives at the moment, but it's clear that we can't keep our eye off the climate crisis. No matter how many other crises may be going on, this is one which will affect the livelihoods of millions of, if not billions of people worldwide. So we as presidency for the remaining 7 months of the year, will continue to push this at leader level and across the globe to ensure that that action is being taken, including on issues such as adaptation, so the consequences of climate change, and on finance where progress was made at Glasgow. We will meet the 100 billion goal next year, but we have to ensure that governments are keeping those commitments. Now, you mentioned climate migration. I think this is just one example of countries dealing with the impacts of climate change. And those are not waiting for us to reach net zero emissions. They're happening here today. And I think as presidency, we have tried to ensure that countries get the support they need to tackle those impacts, which, of course, will reduce the risks of emissions. So we agreed at Glasgow that donors will double international finance to support adaptation in the coming period. And we will maintain this at the very top of the international agenda. Our president, COP president, Arnab Sharma, has made clear he has chaired COP26 from the perspective of the climate vulnerable countries. Those are the countries which must be guiding our approach to climate change, because they are at the forefront of the battle against climate change. Thank you.
Amina, would you say that, and not taking away from all the efforts that are being made at COP26 and then the upcoming COP27, that these conferences and dialogues make any real progress? Because while there is a lot of awareness, I think at some level there's also cynicism, and this awareness has not been converted into the sense of urgency, because one feels that these events have become talk shops.
Well, it does create awareness, as you have said, and I think some of the panelists have also mentioned the importance of having this conversation. But in a way, there has been a fair bit of cynicism, as you have said, because I attended COP21, and COP21, I think, was important for many reasons, because it was one of the successful COPs, because all the previous ones have been disappointing. And there has been one promise made. The promise was to get the climate fund, the 100 billion that we're talking about. And as we speak, we're still short. We still find that there's a gap. And I think at the COP26, I think Mia Motley, actually she was very, very eloquent, and actually she was very articulate in highlighting the crisis that the developing countries are facing. One of the reasons she actually rightly pointed out and is the SDRs, the special drawing rights that developing countries should access. And we find that the climate change, the fund have not been capitalized, and there's still a gap. And the gap, as at November 2021, it was about $26 billion or 21 or something like this. So this shows, this is where I think the cynicism is coming in from developing countries, that the promises are not being met. And if we don't get access to this fund, how are developing countries going to be able to adapt? How are they going to get the tools? And one thing that I think many people, the conversation is missing somewhere, is that we are living in an interconnected world. And if the COVID has shown us anything, it has shown us how interconnected we are to each other and also to the environment. And this is, I think, something which has been missing in our conversation, because as humans, we have taken ourselves out of the environment, and yet we are very much part of it. And if you were to compress the 24 hours in one, well, the whole geological cycle in 24 hours, we find that as humans, we have existed for just 5 seconds before midnight. And just imagine the damage that we have done to this planet. So we are destroying the branch on which we are all sitting. And that is the question, that is the statement that we have to make to our kids. What are we leaving them in terms of legacy when they'll have nothing? And yesterday I was going around the city, and I saw how we need to protect our soil. And in 30 years, there'll be no soil for us to farm on. And this is something that is not taken seriously. This is not something that is, of course, the dollars are not ringing perhaps enough. But we need to look at our environment. We need to show our children that we are very much part of the ecosystem. And the sooner we come to terms with this, the better it's going to be for us.
Right. And this this conversation, this summit is, I think, an effort in that direction. Divya, that since we're talking about the COP, I have to ask, and you represent the United Nations here, do you think we need another mechanism, another platform to come up with enforceable solutions? Because we understand what ties the hands of UN and its bodies, and beyond a point they can't do very much. And the problems and the disagreements remain, the politics remains, and every leader is going to be looking at what is happening at home and then looking at their international responsibility. So national interest versus international responsibility.
I think I also sort of referred to this point earlier, but in any global environmental challenge, I think there is, you know, there is only so much that an international mechanism can do when it comes to national action. And therefore, I wouldn't fault the mechanism. I would say the success of the mechanism will, you know, as I said earlier, will depend on how invested we are in making it successful. And therefore, I wouldn't really say that we need a new mechanism. But what I would say is that, you know, unless we create incentives in the system for business, unless we create incentives in the system for markets to drive the transition and the change just by, you know, heavy-handed policies or interventions. Of course, policies are required, but heavy-handed diktats are not going to sort of, you know, push the transition that we require until the market absorbs it and the market pushes it. So global mechanisms are, in my view, there. What we need is to strengthen market mechanisms which will drive the change that we want to see.
Right, and climate crisis is not a problem in isolation. Eric Solheim, we've seen droughts, wildfires, floods destroy crops. We've seen marine animals being boiled alive in the sea. This happened off the coast of Canada recently. How will countries feed millions of mouths when extreme weather becomes the new normal? And are we working in this direction to address this?
I think the biggest singular potential outcome for India on the negative side is the potential melting of the glaciers in the Himalayas. If that's to happen, it will impact on Ganga, but of course also on Brahmaputra, Indus, Yangtze rivers well beyond the Indian border, and it will have major impact on maybe 2 billion people. So that is a catastrophe which we cannot really fathom, and we need to step up to avoid it. But I believe Ken and his team did a good job in Glasgow. I mean, they brought forward an agreement on deforestation, on methane, and a number of other issues. But I think the focus is wrong. It is not about climate diplomacy any longer. It's about the political economy. So what government leaders and business is doing. Microsoft, which is, of course, a huge company, is doing much more than any country. And it's also much bigger than most countries in the world when it comes to its economy and impact. And just give you a couple of examples. I mean, in Glasgow, the major controversy was about $20 billion. That was the difference between what Hillary Clinton had promised the developing countries on behalf of the rich and what has been actually been delivered. But compare that to what happened in China just 3 weeks after Glasgow. Then the People's Bank of China, the Central Bank of China, launched a low carbon facility for China. That was $1,000 billion, 1,000 versus 20. And even for the poorest nations of the world, the Malawis and the Madagascars of this world, because it's much more important with the low carbon facility in China, because it will lower the price on every available environment technology. That's what's happening now, mainly thanks to China and to India. Since Copenhagen, I was there, I've been to so many of these climate conferences. In 2009, none of us thought of the potential of the price of solar or being reduced by 90%. And it's much more important than any diplomatic talk, because it makes solar energy now available everywhere in the world. You even save money if you move from coal to solar. It's not just for the environment, it's for your wallet, for the state budget. It's an economic drive into solar. And solar energy, by the way, in India, is now the cheapest energy which has ever existed in the world. Solar energy in India is the cheapest energy in the world, cheapest solar energy anywhere. And India, of course, can make an enormous contribution to the world by investing in solar at home, but of course in Africa and many other developing countries.
Ken O'Flaherty, we know that there's a war going on, and this war is triggering an energy crisis in Europe. Do you fear that it could slow down the transition to green energy if this goes on for too long?
I actually think it will speed it up. I think we're seeing it speed it up. The advantages of renewable energy are very clear, and the Minister has mentioned that just now. In two-thirds of the world, it is already cheaper before the crisis to be building new solar than to be building new coal. Now, the increasing cost of fossil fuels are changing that equation even further. And we know, of course, that every single year the cost of solar energy is also falling. So I think that we are seeing many countries, including in Europe, but not also, I would say, within this region, accelerate their move towards renewable energy because it's cheaper, but also because it provides much greater energy security. If you are no longer importing large amounts of oil, gas, and so forth, you are not subject to the vagaries of the international fossil fuel market. And you have much more predictability for your economy, and you have a cheaper source of energy. Now, of course, the fact that energy from renewable sources is cheaper is not the only answer to the problem. We need to have stronger grids, for example, in many countries, including India, to transport the solar energy from where it is produced to where it is needed. We need to ensure that governments provide the incentives for investment by the private sector, which I think I totally agree. The amount of finance coming from the private sector will dwarf anything from the public sector, but there needs to be appropriate structures to attract that investment. And of course, we need to ensure that the countries which already have mature renewables markets, such as the UK, which is one of the world leaders in wind, for example, are sharing our experience with countries in the region. I'm pleased to say that is something which we're already doing with our partners in India. We have advanced dialogues around energy here in India and indeed with many countries across the region. And we're trying to use our presidency to ensure that countries are sharing their expertise and ensuring that this is a joint endeavour to speed up the global energy transition, which will have the benefit of accelerating progress towards the 1.5 degrees Celsius target agreed at Paris. Now, of course, quite apart from the energy transition, there must be a risk now that countries take their eye off the other important issues around climate change, such as helping countries deal with the impacts, which we've been discussing earlier in this discussion. I think that's an area where we, as COP26 presidency, will be working hard to ensure that this remains at the top of the international agenda. As I said earlier, we cannot allow other crises to deflect our attention from the existential.
You've linked war with the species which are destroyed. So I think the first message we have to bring home is that there is no planet B. We only have this planet for which we have to fight, and of course we have to preserve and save for future generations. But I think if you look at war in the Middle East, let's take the war of Syria, for example, part of it is accounted to climate change. And I think we're going to see increased urbanization. And if you look at the continent of Africa, which is going to provide over 1 billion in terms of youth employment, employable people in 10, 15 years' time, we find that it's a continent which is going to increasingly urbanize. And by 2050, I think 50% of the continent is going to be urbanized. So the friction that this will create, and of course, notwithstanding climate impact, of course. So we are in a scenario which doesn't bode well for the future. And we are in a scenario where we'll find food security issues, energy security, water, especially water, because I think it has been forecast, I think the CIA has put in the statement that the next war is going to be the war on water. Transboundary water, fluctuating cycles, you name it, we have it all there. And so notwithstanding that climate change has also impacted 1 million species which are on the verge of extinction. Again, I bring back to the previous statement I made that we are interconnected. So all the species we're destroying, they are in a way ensuring our livelihoods now. So what's the stake in the future when there is no planet B? So that's the question as far as leaders we have to actually embrace in the conversation.
Absolutely, and I think that's a good note to end on. I'm told we're out of time for this session, but thank you very much for joining this conversation, and we'd like to believe it's just the beginning. Thank you once again to our dialogue partners, and most of us understand climate change. We acknowledge the risks of climate change. We understand that this is something that needs to be funded. It is warming the planet. We understand the need for urgent climate solutions, but the question still remains, who is going to pay for this? Who will fund the transformation to a greener world? And I think that is the biggest question that the world faces as it tries to solve this problem. And we want to discuss this in our next session, funding the solution, the commerce of climate change. Please join me in welcoming our keynote speaker for this session, Aminat Shona. She's the Minister of Environment, Climate Change and Technology of the Maldives, and she's opening this session all the way from Male in the Maldives.
The keynote speaker for this session is Aminat Shona, Minister of Environment, Climate Change and Technology, the Maldives. former policy secretary to the president of the Maldives.
First of all, thank you for having me here, and a real pleasure to be with our friends from India. As you're probably already aware, the Maldives is very climate vulnerable. The highest point in our country is just about 1.5 meters above the sea. And we are 1,200 islands, so the sea is just all around us. Sea level rise is a threat to our existence, which is why reducing global greenhouse gas emissions is a question of national security for us. We have increased problems of coastal erosion now happening on most of our islands. Groundwater is contaminated on every island, and our coral reefs are under stress from warming. As an island nation, our oceans are connected to every aspect of our lives, our economy, and our future. We are only as resilient as our reefs, depending on them for our survival and livelihood. The problem the Maldives face is one of finance. We need access to affordable finance so we can invest in solar energy projects. The Indian government is already providing concessional financing for the Maldives to build water and sanitation systems in 34 islands, one of the largest adaptation measures. Similarly, India and Indian renewable energy companies can play a big role. We would like you to come to the Maldives and help us to build our new and renewable energy infrastructure. I take this opportunity to call upon our international community and partners to step up action, not only in climate mitigation ambition, but also in support for vulnerable states, as true climate justice would only be achieved through effective solutions to address the devastating impacts of the climate crisis. Despite the gravity of our adaptation needs and the magnitude of the investments required to build resilience, we also aim to demonstrate leadership in global mitigation ambition. At a global scale, our total contribution to global emissions is negligible. It's just about 0.0035%. Yet, we are determined to be a driver of the global solution. At the moment, the Maldivian economy is largely run on imported diesel, which is dirty, expensive, volatile in price, and a huge drain on our nation's foreign currency reserves. The Maldives would like to rapidly deploy renewable energy, primarily solar, which is no surprise given our reputation as a sunshine holiday destination.
That honest and heartfelt message from the Maldives.
That was the opening plenary from a climate change conference held a few months ago in New Delhi, India, organized by the World is One Network, an English language independent news agency based in India. There's another climate conference coming up next week, the 27th annual COP conference, which brings together representatives from many nations to draft climate change strategies. Its reports are not binding, but are intended to serve as guidelines to inform climate change policies and international agreements. But while such conferences are necessary and have some value, climate justice activists are often critical of them for not going far enough. Greta Thunberg, a Swedish activist who made quite an impression at the last two COP conferences, is skipping this one, and she was interviewed last week on ABC News. ABC, that is, the Australian broadcast company.
Greta Thunberg, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
In your new book, you appear to be despairing of our chances of saving the planet. Is that a fair assessment of where you are right now?
I don't think so, actually. People often ask me whether I'm a pessimist or an optimist when it comes to saving the climate. And I always say that I'm a realist. It is definitely possible for us to avoid the worst consequences of this crisis, but not if we continue like now. There is certainly opportunities and chances for us to be able to save what we can possibly save. But as long as we continue like we are now, there's not very much hope in sight. But the hopeful thing is that we can change what we consider to be politically possible. We can change social norms and we can change our behavior.
You say that in your book. You say that we can't live sustainably within the world's economic system, and there are predictions that the world economy will double in size by 2050. So how do you produce the kind of change that you want to see in the face of that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Of course, we don't know exactly how to do that. If we knew the answer to that, then this wouldn't be as big of a crisis as it is. When I say that we can't live sustainably within an unsustainable world, one very clear example of that is how, for example, I was just sitting right now calculating my own carbon footprint. And even if I click that I do everything right, I still exceed the planetary boundaries just by existing and just by paying taxes. So it's impossible to live sustainably today. And that is also one of the main reasons why I chose to sail across the Atlantic Ocean twice, to show that it's completely impossible to even try to live sustainably, because it's just our societies are not built like that. And for us to change that, it will take a lot. Of course, we need to move away from looking at individual behavior to looking at having a more systemic approach. But it's a good reflection and a good kind of measurement to just see how bad the situation actually is and how far away from even what would be the bare minimum is.
You clearly think that the phrase climate change isn't enough now to describe the situation that we're in, that the climate is breaking down and destabilizing. Do you think that that process is irreversible?
I mean, it's not a matter of whether I think something is reversible or not. Science clearly shows that already now, already at 1.5 degrees of global average temperature rise, we will be seeing irreversible tipping points beyond human control that we will not be able to reverse.
The big climate change conference in Egypt is about to start. Now, you condemned the last one as a failure and a PR exercise, and you said that the leaders were guilty of decades of blah, blah, blah. Do you expect any more from this one?
I do not, unfortunately. But as it is now, the COPs are not designed to really change anything. That's not why they exist. And right now, it's like they are being turned into an opportunity for big polluters to greenwash themselves. As long as it is now, as long as the level of awareness is so low as it is now, then people will not be able to have the knowledge they need to put pressure on the people in power, and then they will continue to get away with not doing enough. And they will use words against us, using greenwashing, in order to make it seem like they're doing something when they're not, using PR tactics and communication strategies disguised as politics. The way that COP27 would for me be considered a success or a step forward would be that more people realize what a scam it actually is under current circumstances. But of course, having that said, it means a lot to have representation at the COP, COP27, and having people most affected by the climate crisis, having the people who are fighting on the front lines of the climate crisis who are being hit the hardest, is absolutely crucial. These COPs are an opportunity to mobilize and to spread awareness about the climate crisis. But we have to bear in mind that it will not be enough.
That was Swedish activist Greta Thunberg speaking critically about the upcoming International Climate Change Conference. And this has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time in your community radio stations, WCRS LP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRN LP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis. I hope that you all get out there and vote. It's really critical. I'll be doing the same, and I'll hope to see you next week for another edition. Take care. program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.